You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, so time for our reporter roundtable. This is where we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. And let me tell you, there's been a lot. So let's get right to it. My guest today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News. He is at the State House joining us on the phone. Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press of Idaho and Don Day with BoiseDev.com. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
It is a busy one. So, Rebecca, I want to start with you because you have been following this case regarding Joseph Duncan. First off, for people who may not be familiar with the name Joseph Duncan, because the crimes he committed happened in 2005, we're talking 15 years ago, quickly update us on what happened.
Sure. So this was a crime that just shocked the entire Northwest, or the U.S., actually. It was incredibly heinous. So this is a guy who had gotten out of prison in the Midwest. He was traveling across country looking for the right target to commit what he said wanted to be like the worst crime ever. He spots two young children outside of their home near Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, decides that they're good targets for him. He sort of watches that house, eventually breaks in, kills three members of the family. So the mom, her significant other, an older brother, kidnaps the 7 and the 8-year-old that he had been watching, and then goes into the Montana wilderness, deep into the Lolo Forest. And so they were gone. Nobody knew where they went. They knew that the family had been murdered. They knew that, that the kids were missing.
An Amber Alert for days on end.
Right,
days.
Right. Yeah. We all covered this.
And it was weeks. And eventually, Joseph Duncan was caught because he took the girl back to Coeur d'Alene for reasons that aren't fully understood. And a waitress at Denny's recognized them. So it turns out the two children had been tortured and abused sexually and otherwise in the woods for weeks. And he actually killed the little boy out there.
So fast forward us to this recent part of his case, because he was convicted.
Yes.
Given the death penalty, correct?
Correct.
So this week, a federal judge made a ruling.
Right. So a federal judge, he was sentenced to death for three of like the 10 crimes he was convicted of in the federal case. And the federal judge said basically two of those three death penalties are solid. You know, I'm upholding them. Death penalty is moving forward on those two. The third, though, there is some potential case law that's going to be coming out soon in both the Ninth Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court that could impact Duncan's case. These other cases aren't his cases, but they have similar arguments against this one specific law that resulted in the death penalty. And so the judge is holding off on that one until he hears the rulings from the Ninth Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court so that he can take that under advisement as he makes his ruling in Duncan's case.
Do we know what that piece is that they're waiting to hear about?
Right. So it's basically like an enhancement in that you can be sentenced to death in federal court if you use a firearm in furtherance of violence resulting in death. And so Joseph Duncan was convicted of using a firearm in furtherance of this kidnapping and sexual exploitation of children and murder. But the argument is that the law might be unconstitutionally vague. Like, it might not be clear enough exactly how a firearm might be used in furtherance of violence. So it might just be a little too loosey-goosey, and that's the argument going before the appellate courts now.
And I have to say, getting back to this case, you're right. It shocked the nation in how heinous it was. I happened to be in Tampa, Florida at the time as a news anchor. Don, you said you were in Seattle.
Yeah.
But Kevin, you also have some personal experience with this because you were called for potential jury duty, correct?
Yes, I was one of the hundreds of people who were called in as potential jurors for the sentencing phase of this case. And I did not make the cut. I was eliminated as a potential juror fairly early in the process, to my great relief. You know, as we watched this case unfold and as we heard what the jury had to hear and had to process in that sentencing process, I think often of the 12 jurors and the three alternates who had to listen to all of that, who had to process that, and have had to live with that now for the 11 years since that since that sentencing phase of the trial. I mean, this was in my former life as a Statesman editorial page editor, and I wrote at the time, partly about my experience, but much more about the jurors, and just, questioned, what does this serve in terms of justice, and what are we putting these jurors through? I think it's an important question still that, needs to be asked and needs to be considered, as one of the many things that we as a society have to think about when we think about the death penalty.
I sat through that trial gavel to gavel, and it was the hardest thing I have ever had to cover. And I've covered a lot. I have witnessed executions. Mm-hmm. I have seen people killed. This was the hardest thing I've ever seen. And I can tell you that some jurors had to go to PTSD therapy because it was so traumatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Law enforcement, some of the reporters, I'm sure. Law enforcement officers I know in Northern Idaho who were directly on the case had to go to PTSD therapy. And then my understanding after talking to the sheriff up there is that their therapist had to go to therapy from just hearing it. It was horrific.
I think when we think about the process, we think about the policy of capital punishment, that all has to be factored in. I mean, we think first and foremost about the families and the loved ones of the victims, as we should. But I think we need to remember that there's a whole other groups of people who are affected by proceeding with a sentencing phase like we had in this case.
And before we wrap this part up, there was a survivor, and she is an adult now. And I think she is who I think about because of everything that she went through. So we have to remember her, too.
Right. And that's one thing that I kept thinking throughout the trial is, as hard as this is for everyone in the room, there's a family that has been deeply, deeply impacted, and especially one little girl at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So moving on, Dawn, want to go in to the new Albertsons CEO that was announced this morning. And which number are we on for the year?
Yeah. So in the last year, this is the third person to be named to serve as CEO of Albertsons. And we covered the company pretty closely on Boise Dev. And a big reason for that is they're the third largest private company in the nation behind Cargill and Koch Industries. They're a $60 billion company.
Did you just say in the nation?
In the nation, yeah. If you compare that with Micron, Micron's about an $8 billion a year company in revenue. So Albertsons is a really big, it's a really big company, not just here in the Valley, but across the country. And it's been kind of an interesting year. So I had to kind of chart this out because there's been so many changes that I was surprised at. So many people remember a year ago, last February of 18, Albertsons announced it would merge with Rite Aid. And at the time, they said that that company's CEO, John Standley, would become the combined CEO of the two entities.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Donald, who is the current CEO, was bumped up and given a job at Albertsons as chief operating officer. Then in August of last year, the Albertsons Rite Aid deal fell through, probably because it wasn't going to get Rite Aid shareholder approval. So Bob Miller, who had been CEO for a long time of this company and has deep roots here in the Treasure Valley, continued on as CEO for a little while. Then the next month, Jim Donald, who'd come on just a few months earlier to be CEO, COO, got the CEO job. And now here we are in March of 2019, after just about a year, and the company today, and somewhat of a surprise, named Vivek Sankaran as the new CEO. He comes from PepsiCo's North American Foods division. That includes brands like Fritos, Doritos, Lay's, Quaker Oats. So he has kind of a consumer packaged goods background. So he will take over. Jim Donald will stay on as co-chair of the board. They're going to bring in another co-chair. And then Bob Miller, who I think it's fair to say is a huge booster of Boise and is probably the biggest reason why the company is again based here on Park Center Boulevard, will become chairman emeritus and will keep a seat on the board. And he's in his 70s, so I think he's been looking to retire for a while.
Mm-hmm.
This company has been trying to figure out what to do. They wanted to go public. Pardon me. They'd announced an IPO, and they couldn't get that through. There's been a lot of problems in the retail industry that I think anybody knows. And then they said, well, let's merge with Rite Aid. That'll get us to a public company status. That didn't work. And Albertsons is largely controlled by private equity firms, and they don't generally hold on to companies for 10 and 15 years, which is kind of what the territory we're starting to see with Albertsons. So you would imagine at some point they're going to want liquidity from their investment, but they don't know how to make that happen. Maybe this new CEO factors into a play. A lot of story to be told here, and it's really interesting to cover and follow. And lots of people work for Albertsons or are secondarily impacted by some of the other companies that have moved here to serve Albertsons.
So this is just kind of the beginning of what could happen. Yeah. And we don't know.
And it always makes people nervous when Sanjay Marotta was named CEO of Micron. He's based in California and kind of in Idaho. Mm-hmm. And people always go, oh, are we going to be okay here? I think generally, you know, the CEO's geography is less important to a company's headquarters than maybe it once was.
But do we know if this new CEO will come to Boise? We don't know.
The press release today was pretty basic and just outlined kind of what I just talked about. I think those details will come in days to weeks to come. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be super worried about it, but it's always something that is in the back of employees' minds and leaders' minds, and everybody thinks, ooh, new CEO that's not from here. What
does that mean?
What's that mean? And so that's something to follow closely.
Yeah. I want to shift gears and hit to the legislature because, Kevin, you are there right now following what's been going on with Senate Bill 1159. And just quickly get us updated. I do want you to know Senate Minority Leader Matt Erpelding is going to be coming in a little bit later on the program to talk about this because, Kevin, this has gotten heated, to say the least.
It very much did. So the House passed 1159, the initiative overhaul bill, after more than 2 hours of debate, and really some of the most interesting and riveting debate that I've heard on the House floor in a long time. It was fascinating stuff and dramatic and very tense. 40-30 was the margin on that bill. The House then followed up and passed it's being called the trailer bill. It changes some of the numbers in terms of timetable to get signatures gathered, how many legislative districts you would have to gather signatures in. That trailer bill, that passed by a 47-22 vote. That just happened a couple of minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. So now what happens with this, Kevin? Because as some people are calling it, the revenge against voters bill, but this has to go in front of the governor, yes?
Yeah. So what happens now is that this bill, 1159, now goes to the governor's desk. The trailer bill that passed, that still has to go to the Senate. The Senate has never taken this up. And mind you, this bill just surfaced yesterday after a very hastily arranged meeting of House Ways and Means Committee. So we don't know what's going to happen with that bill in the Senate. And that was, you know, but we do know that Senate Bill 1159 now goes to the governor's desk, and the governor has not said where he is on this. Neither House passed this bill with a veto-proof majority, not even close. Not in either chamber was it very close. And that was one of the things that was really fascinating about the debate today. You had Democrats opposing this in force. You mentioned Matt Erpelding. He was very passionate about this. It became, you know, there was sort of a sidebar during the debate where, you know, he said he was being wrongly admonished for stepping out of line in debate. You had Democrats debating against. You had conservative Republicans like Heather Scott, who I thought had, you know, made a very powerful argument against this. So you had, you know, the two, you had, you know, the far right and Democrats kind of coming together against.
Well, yeah.
This. Bottom line is, if the governor vetoes this, there's no way that I could see this veto being overridden. Their votes have just not been there.
But
we don't know where the governor is on this.
So, right, because he hasn't said anything.
Right, and governors hardly ever do. Governors like to hold that close to the vest.
That's
they don't
right.
want to have to tip their hand until that time comes. A lot of arguments about what this does in terms of making initiatives more difficult to get on a ballot. A lot of arguments about the constitutionality of 1159. And I have to wonder, you know, really when you get down to it, the debate today, there were a lot of people in the gallery, but there was an audience of one today, and then that's the governor. And I wonder, to what degree does the governor listen to the debate? To what degree does he process what was discussed in the debate? And to what degree does the debate inform his decision, whatever that decision turns out to be? Because he's going to have to address these concerns, whether he signs this into law or vetoes it. A lot of concerns have been raised, and it all kind of comes down to the governor at this point.
And listening to the voice of the voters, right? Because these initiatives were brought, because, you know, a lot of people argue that this is because of Medicaid being expanded and that getting on the ballot in November and the way that it was. So where does the governor weigh in on the voice of the people as well? So you're right, Kevin, there's a lot to
watch. And weigh in on the voice on this bill, because the testimony in committee hearings on this has been overwhelmingly opposed to 1159. So whatever the governor does, he's going to have to address public concerns, constitutional issues, process in terms of what this does in terms of the initiative, the hurdles to get an initiative on the ballot. So he's got, this may be the biggest decision he has to make this legislative session, even a bigger decision maybe than whatever comes down the pike with Medicaid.
We are continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guest, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, and Don Day with BoiseDev.com. Don, City of Boise and the developer for a potential ballpark stadium.
Yes.
They are negotiating?
Yeah, they're deep into negotiations. So looking at some public records from December, it was clear that they were having meetings on about four different documents and trying to detail the finer points of these things. So it was a master development agreement, a purchase and sale agreement, a stadium license agreement, and then a tax increment financing assurance agreement. So you see this in an email as a reporter, and you go, sweet, I want to see this.
Yeah, right.
And so I put in a records request. I kind of knew it was going to be denied because I had seen that my colleagues at the Idaho Press had also made this request, and I hadn't seen any reporting. But it did, in fact, get denied. And I decided to go ahead and write a story on it to talk about the process. The city spokesperson, Mike Journey, was emphatic that this is kind of how this goes, right? You're making these negotiations. You're trying to get the best deal for the taxpayers and the public. And if you have those documents out, it kind of messes with the flow of a negotiation. But what it does tell us, though, is that Greenstone Properties in the City of Boise are really working to get this next stadium project up and going. They've got a lot of hurdles, and I wrote about that a little bit this week on BoiseDev.com to make that happen. So we'll see where it goes. And you've got this legislation hanging out there over tax increment financing and urban renewal that will play in. So it's going to be an interesting story. I actually counted. I've written 43 stories on the stadium.
Oh, my goodness.
Dating back,
and you're going to write 43 more.
Yeah, dating back to 2016, and it's been good for my business certainly to write about this because there's high interest on all sides of it.
Rebecca, let's talk about the latest with Medicaid expansion. We had some Medicaid folks on the program Wednesday talking about the latest, because there have been some things happening. Literally after the program gets over with on Wednesday, more happens, but it has to do with a ruling in the state of Arkansas.
And
correct?
Also Kentucky.
And Kentucky, yeah. So tell us about what happened, because all of a sudden everything just went kind of full stop in our legislature.
Sure. So there has been lawsuits in these other states over the work requirements. Mm-hmm. And the courts in those states just said, can't do it. But, you know, basically shot down the work requirements. So that brought the committee meeting to kind of a screeching halt. And, you know, they held it. They held it, which it essentially could kill it. But this is something like the initiatives bill. This is changing by the moment.
So, it really is.
There was a what some have been called like a compromise bill.
This is the voluntary.
That would have voluntary work requirements.
Right.
So that's similar to what happened in Montana.
Right.
And Montana has said that it's been very successful. So people can volunteer for work training that can help them find a job, that can help them transition to a place where they no longer require Medicaid. So that was supposed to come up in the Senate today, everybody thought, in the amending order, which means they were going to talk about potential changes to that bill. But they held off. They decided not to deal with it today, and it should come up theoretically on Monday.
And they got a lot to deal with. Okay, so Kevin, still more going on in the state house. School funding formula, but also there are some bills maybe not, I would say maybe flying under the radar a bit, and these are regarding charter schools?
Yeah, let's talk first about the funding formula.
Okay.
And Don, I'll have to do the math. Clark Corbin and I have probably written 43 stories about the funding formula bill in the legislature. So we feel your pain.
Yeah.
The ongoing saga of the funding formula. Right now, what you have is a bill, and it hasn't been voted on in the House yet. It's sort of pending. That would set definitions for how you would do a rewrite of the funding formula and how you would define student groups that need more need more financial support. It costs more to teach a special education student or an English language learner or student subgroups like of the like. So this bill would sort of set those definitions. It would require the districts and the charter schools to gather data about their student numbers to set the stage for maybe doing a funding formula in 2020 or beyond. I think it's sort of a last-ditch attempt to get something done this year on this issue to kind of move the issue forward. It's pending on the House floor. It didn't come up today because, lo and behold, the House spent most of the morning on initiatives.
Mm-hmm. So then talk to us about charter schools, Kevin, and what's going on with that. Because this is, for a lot of people, the first time we're hearing about bills regarding charter schools this session.
It has been below the radar, a pretty busy session for charter school advocates and charter school legislation, one that totally flew under the radar and passed both houses within 2 weeks. So a very fast-track bill would sort of create a financial backstop, a couple of state funds that would protect against a charter school defaulting on bond payments. And the idea is that this fund that would be paid for by the charter schools and set up at the state level would provide protection and might allow charter schools to get a lower interest rate and spend less money on financing a bond issue and then have more money that they could spend on classroom programs. That's passed both houses. That goes to the governor. The governor did sign a bill last week that really relaxes the hiring requirements for charter school administrators. Charter groups have been pushing for this for a couple of years. Governor Otter vetoed it on the last day of the session last year. Governor Little signed it into law and said, okay, we're going to give you this relaxed hiring authority, but it's incumbent upon the charter schools to show that they're using this to innovate, that that's been the mission of charter schools, the stated mission for 20 years. If we're going to give you this latitude, do something with it. And he said, you know, in his letter explaining his signature on the bill, said, I've heard the criticisms about this. And the criticism is that this waters down the job requirements for a charter school administrator. Why would you do this? He says he's heard those concerns and he's going to be watching closely to see how it plays out. So, you know, again, these bills have not gotten as much attention as other education legislation, certainly not as much attention as Medicaid or the initiative bills, but pretty important stuff within the charter school sector.
Oh, absolutely, especially when you look at how many charter schools we have. So we are starting to run out of time, but Don, I do I want to end with, shall we say, a kerfuffle, because I you know, don't get to use that word very often, over a spitting incident at Treefort.
Yeah, so hat tip to Harrison Berry over at the Boise Weekly, who had a story this morning that just kind of made my eyes grow wide. Apparently, there was a library employee who was taking surveys at Treefort who was spat upon. This person told the library director, Kevin Boo, about this. The Boise Weekly says that Kevin then took to social media and was very upset, understandably. But he called on two groups that are I guess, ostensibly opposed to the library, both Vanishing Boise and Boise Working Together, to disavow it. And the Boise Weekly ran a pretty lengthy story on it, talked to Kevin and also talked to the city spokesperson. But Lori DeCari over at Vanishing Boise was upset because they didn't really talk to her. Turns out that the spitting didn't have anything to do with anti-library sentiment, at least according to the Boise Weekly, and it was probably somebody who was just inebriated. Lori put out on Facebook today, you know, we know nothing about it, and we don't advocate spitting. Don't spit, folks. We disavow it. And she was a little salty that the Boise Weekly story didn't call her and ask kind of her
if she had spat or someone in her group had.
Yeah, and it kind of nexuses back to this whole Boise Kind initiative that launched at Treefort, which I think is a noble idea to encode that. People are a little upset that $80,000 is being spent of public dollars for a consultant to help push this through. And it is an election year, and so that definitely raises questions in some people's mind. Dave Frazier, the Boise Guardian, first mm-hmm. surfaced this. And since then, there's been reports in the Statesman or Idaho Press and maybe KTVB. So it's caught some attention and has people asking questions why this money is being spent. And then you just kind of nexus this all together with this unfortunate incident and the reaction to it. And boy, this time we're in Boise and in the Treasure Valley is definitely making for some hot moments.
Here's what I have to say. So I have two boys. They have spat upon each other. And I have said, be kind. Spitting is not kind.
No.
There has not been $80,000 taken around our house to push the initiative of being kind. So where would this $80,000 be spent to push out an initiative to be kind?
Yeah, so it's being paid to a third-party consultant about $6,000 a month for, you know, helping build a steering committee and do some things around this. And I think anybody would say that the sort of root of this campaign is a great idea.
Oh, absolutely, right? Within the culture and climate that we live in this day and age, to be able to do that at the same time, it goes back to we have to tell people to be kind.
Sure. And I think, you know, it's a music festival. I think Tree Fort's a great thing for the city. This isn't really about them. It's just people are drinking and it's a close environment and things happen.
Look, they're drinking. They're spitting.
Spit happens.
Spit happens. And maybe they drank something they didn't like.
Right.
And they spat upon the individual. But again, what did she say?
She said,
because it's the best.
Don't spit, folks. At least she says, don't spit, folks. At least not unless you are spit upon. We disavow it.
Even if you're spit upon,
if somebody spits on me, I'm not gonna spit back.
Do not spit back.
Strange times.
Strange. as always, some of my favorite times of the week. I thank all three of you for coming in today. It has been busy, crazy with the legislature, everything else going on. Don't spit. Be kind. My guest today, Rebecca Boone with the Associated and Rewind. Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, Dante with Boise Dev.